Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is a very hot day in June 9th, 2011. Thank you to all of our listeners. We've reached over 20,000 listens, and we continue to have more people sharing, twittering, putting the widget on their website. I encourage you to do that to spread the awareness about vaccinations and your rights in the United States, learning about your rights and your right to have an exemption or a waiver if you don't want to have a vaccination for yourself or your children. I would like to introduce Alan for those people who are new listeners. Alan is an attorney at law in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He is one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys and advises individuals, families, attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccination exemptions and waivers. He also supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice, and we will be hearing some more about that specifically today. And it's always great to read about what he proposes to legislators and to support the families who want to have choice in their lives and their children's lives to take care of themselves. And he's also a featured guest on Freedomizer Radio, Liberty News Radio, and on many other boards around the country. So take a listen to what Alan has to say today about the topic. Do you think that children should have the right to make their own health care decisions? And I will lead in with that, Alan.
Well, good afternoon, Debbie. It's a pleasure to be here with you, as always. I tell you, I never know what's going to come up. We spoke two or three shows ago at length about an issue local to us right here in Central North Carolina, where my own school district had a vaccine contest as a way of encouraging adolescents to get vaccinated with non-mandatory vaccines. And as you recall, those who participate would be entered into a drawing for an iPad or a laptop computer. Needless to say, that's something that evoked considerable outcry from the anti-vaccine community and people from all over the country. And in fact, even some people, I think, from outside of the country expressed concern by writing emails to the local school board and the superintendent. Turns out that contest was initially started with the county health department, but a lot of people went to the school board and the superintendent for the district because they had posted information about it on the superintendent's blog. Well, that issue raised an interesting question because a lot of people were wondering or making assumptions with regard to whether or not these adolescent students could go out and get vaccinated without their parents' consent. And quite by accident, to be perfectly honest with you, if indeed there are ultimately any accidents, I, in looking up a law, discovered that there was a bill pending here in North Carolina to modify an already existing law that gives minors a certain amount of authority to consent to certain kinds of medical treatment. And the bill in North Carolina to modify that was, if I recall and understood correctly, only wanting to add a requirement to that, that when a physician treats a child 12 or under, that after they treat, that they would have to notify the parents, by the way, your child has just been treated for whatever it was. So it was just sort of a minor...
Isn't that too late?
Well, for any of us who have the a reaction, same or similar to my own, to the idea of minors being able to consent to treatment at all, which was sort of, well, wait a second, isn't that a parent's domain? You know, isn't that sort of, and I'm speaking not at this point not on a legal level, but just sort of a common sense level. As a parent myself, I felt usurped. I felt like, well, wait a second. I don't want my kid going off and getting treatment for something without me knowing about it and agreeing to it. Now, there's a general exception across the board here, and there needs to be, for emergency situations. I mean, if a physician, you know, if your child's walking across the street on his way to or home from to or from school, gets hit by a car and needs to be rushed to the hospital and treated, if they don't have time to notify you ahead of time, they need to go ahead and treat the child. I mean, if they have the child's bleeding to death or whatever, you know, some serious situation. So I think most people would agree that in an emergency, whatever needs to be done needs to be done. Now, we could split hairs
I would say that when you enter your child in school, you actually sign off on a form that tells where you write the name of your doctor for your child, and it does. You do waive that right. As far as I recall, when I sent my kids to school, I did have to send that type of a form in with them at the beginning of the year. And I also recall, and this is a long time ago, for dental checkups or vision checkups and things like that, we also had to sign waivers for them to be screened for certain things. I do not recall ever having to sign anything regarding that they would be giving vaccinations in school. So those are a few of the range of medical care types of situations that a child or a parent might come into.
Well, we have, yes, and I as well with my children. We have in our legal system, and this broad generality here, but sort of built into the system is that a lot of standard rights or routines, procedures can temporarily at least go out the window in the context of an emergency. We've talked about that with regard to emergency vaccines, because when Obama declared a swine flu emergency back in 2009, that paved the way legally for vaccine manufacturers to do the so-called fast-tracked vaccines, where they do much less testing, they do a more rushed production and so forth, presumably to deal with the emergency. Now, there are many different issues or situations where emergencies might be involved, where reasonable people would disagree about what constitutes an emergency, and that's a discussion I want to put over to the side for the moment. But as a general concept, I think most people would agree, and certainly to me it's as a matter of common sense, is a reasonable proposition that there should be provisions within our legal system and with regard, for example, to treating minors for medical issues, that if there's an emergency, we want the children to be able to be treated if it's going to save their life or prevent or minimize long-term injury or suffering, whether or not the parents can be notified. Now, here's, you know, again, we can split hairs about what counts as an emergency, what fits into that definition, but the general concept, I think, is valid. For me, the issue about whether or not rights can or should go away temporarily in an emergency context is not about an absolute sense about whether that can or should happen, but rather who gets to decide when it happens, who gets to determine what the criteria is. Because there, you know, one of the standard situations are where parents decide they don't want to submit their children who have a chronic condition to a conventional allopathic treatment because they've done the research themselves. They think an alternative treatment is actually going to work better. And ironically, parents in those situations may be absolutely correct, and yet the law often favors the orthodox allopathic treatment, and parents can be forced to submit their children sometimes to treatments that they don't want to do. You know, so that's a serious issue and legitimate question as just an example. But the larger general concept of emergencies sometimes genuinely and legitimately require somebody to step in, and therefore somebody else is going to temporarily lose a right. But when we're talking about today children's right to consent, and just to sort of tie this in, you know, this is a vaccines and your rights. When I was looking at current law in both North Carolina and California that just came to my attention in the last couple of days, there are laws on the books currently in those states, and I suspect other states as well, given that it's happened on both coasts in these two particular states, that allow minors to consent to a certain amount of treatment or certain kinds of medical treatment without parental consent. And when that issue first came up to me in the context of the vaccine contest here in North Carolina, my first thought was, well, a minor can't consent to vaccines because we have a religious exemption law here in North Carolina, and a minor child's religious beliefs for legal purposes are deemed to be that of the parent or parents. And so a minor in consenting to a vaccine could potentially be going against a parent's religious beliefs and religious objections to immunizations. And so to me, the law, at least as it would pertain to or allow a child to consent to immunizations without the parent's knowledge and agreement, would violate the First Amendment of the Constitution, the First Amendment's free exercise of religion. But that didn't address anything outside of the context of vaccines in terms of medical treatment. And when I thought about this issue more and remembered a Supreme Court case, I had to go back and look it up because I haven't read it for quite some time, but there is a U.S. Supreme Court case. It's Troxell v. Granville. It's a 2000 case, so it's only 11 or so years old.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a case that was dealing with a child custody law in Washington State. So it's a different topic than what we're talking about here, medical consent. But I think it's a case that has application nonetheless, because in the Troxell case, there was a question about the way the Washington law was worded as to who can petition the state for custody or visitation of a child and who can't. So that's a question that goes to the issue of what is a parent's right to rear their own children. What's the scope under our federal constitution of a parent's right to make decisions? In this particular case, can a parent decide that a grandparent can't have contact with the child if they want to? Now, I imagine if we use our imaginations, we could come up with hypothetical situations where that would just be atrocious and where that would be absolutely appropriate. But the question is, who gets to decide? And ultimately what the court decided in that case is that we have a due process right under the 14th Amendment to rear our children, and it's a very strong right and standard under that case. And the only time a parent, and that right is a presumption. In other words, we're presumed to have that right unless and until there's some kind of showing that the parent is not fit to exercise that right. There's a presumption that parents are going to make decisions that are in the best interests of their children. And so it raised the question for me then when I was looking at these California and North Carolina laws that allow children to consent to medical treatment in certain areas and situations. And by the way, these areas appear to very clearly include immunizations, but these laws don't refer to immunizations directly. They talk about prevention of disease and other phrases that, again, very clearly seem to refer to and would a very obvious and reasonable interpretation would allow immunization. So from my point of view as one who's regularly involved in legislative issues around the country concerning vaccines, these laws are of great concern to me, because those of us who are using standard search methods to find laws or bills that concern vaccines, if you use the word vaccine or vaccination or immunization, you're not going to pull up these laws or these bills because they're not referring to immunizations directly. So we have to be more careful. This is just my own informal phrase, but I consider bills or laws that provide for immunization of children or anyone without using the word immunization or vaccination as sort of stealth vaccine laws or stealth vaccine bills, because they can slip under the radar screen of the anti-vaccine legislative advocates if they're not very watchful. Because, again, if you're searching with terms like vaccine, vaccination, immunization, you're not going to pull up these bills and laws. So
Can I ask just kind of like a summary to see about what we're talking about here? Giving parents the right to take care of their children and have the responsibility for them. And I'm not exactly sure and fully understanding reasons why the law has seen fit to give the parent total control over their health care. Is it religious reasons that the child might be uninformed about information, just general information, or information about the parent's belief system, or perhaps the child is too immature to make a decision? I mean, there seems to be a lot of different reasons why the parent, who is responsible for the welfare of the child, should have the final say. And even if a child goes to get pierced ears, you have to have a parent's consent, which is something really minor, and children do this all the time. So when it comes to injecting something into their body or taking a certain kind of drug or medication, and Dr. Bob, who is on the chat, also mentioned science published a story about the array of toxins that include mercury that are now definitely physiologically correlated to autism. I mean, we're constantly coming out with new information, new science, new reports. And who is going to be the person who is at the forefront of caring for that child?
Well, I think there was probably no fewer than at least half a dozen different
You want to split
questions
that
and
up?
Issues there. not intentionally on your part, but just in by inference on my part, because there's so many different aspects. I mean, on one level, this is very simple, maybe even simplistic in that. It's my understanding from this Troxell case that parents have a 14th Amendment due process right to rear their children, except where there's a showing that they are unfit, or in an emergency context, their right to make decision might be temporarily suspended. Somebody else might have to make a decision in an emergency. But the vast majority of the time, it's the parental right. But I think the first question that came up as I was listening to you to there was, we need to distinguish. It's important for each of us to consider questions like, well, what do we think our rights should be? I mean, that's sort of a fundamental common sense starting place. What should our right be? And a lot of us as parents in particular, where the question here is not purely hypothetical, it's something we deal with daily as parents. You know, what do we think our rights should be? But it's important, equally important, maybe even in specific issues, more important to recognize that there can at times be a difference, or even a huge difference, between what we think our rights should be and what they actually are. So let me give an example. You know, Debbie, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm putting words into your mouth, but it seems to me that to you, the idea of a child being able to consent to medical treatment, at least outside of an emergency context, is offensive or maybe even repulsive that you feel like as a parent, you don't want your child being treated without you being involved and informed and involved in that decision and so forth. And I am arguing that these current laws in California and North Carolina are unconstitutional. But the fact of the matter is, in terms of legal analysis, that these laws are on the books and they are, quote-unquote, good law, unless and until they are either repealed by a legislature or a court strikes it as unconstitutional. And unfortunately...
And these laws that you are referring to give children the ability to make their own health care decisions in non-emergency.
Well, let me give an example because the laws, the laws in these two states, you know, are not by any means identical. So let me just read to you, for example, what North Carolina's current law, minors' consent. This is it's section 90-21.5, and it's labeled minors' consent sufficient for certain medical health services. I mean, so right off the bat, it's not just a broad open, a minor can consent to anything at any time they want to. There are some very specific limitations here, but it's also broad enough that I believe both of the laws in North Carolina and California would include the administration of vaccines, and that concerns me. And please remind me if I don't reel myself back in that there's sort of two levels to my own process as I was looking at this issue and to constitutional concerns. But here's what the North Carolina law says. Any minor, and that, boy, that is broad. You know, that means an infant right on up to the day before you turn 18. Any minor may give effective consent to a physician licensed to practice medicine in North Carolina for medical health services for, and then there's a list here, the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of, one, venereal disease and other diseases reportable under GS 138-135. And I haven't looked at 138-135 real recently, but I expect that's any of the standard infectious diseases. Those are all reportable. The ones with vaccines and other ones that don't have vaccines, I'm sure, are reportable too. For the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of pregnancy, and for the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of abuse of controlled substances or alcohol, and then the fourth category listed here is emotional disturbance. Now, for our purposes as a vaccine right show, the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of venereal disease and other diseases, that's just really broad. Prevention, of course, could include immunizations. So while this is much broader than just immunizations, for our purposes primarily, this concerns me. They're basically saying any child can say, I want to be immunized. Now, this raises huge flags for me in that there has been movement here in North Carolina and other states to set up schools as flu vaccine distribution centers. Now, I expect we're not going to see that move forward rapidly anywhere in the U.S. right now for purely financial reasons. You know, probably most of the states are operating in the red, and the last thing they want to do financially is set up a statewide state expense of schools as flu distribution centers. But you can, you know, there's.
They could partner with the pharmacies. They could partner with, you know, go to your local pharmacy, go to your local mall. Go anywhere to they're already giving it there.
Well, the point is I don't think any of this is accidental or coincidental. Mm-hmm. We have a movement and push to have schools become, around the country, to have schools become vaccine distribution centers. Meanwhile, we have laws being passed that allow children to consent. So even though schools might send home notices and say we're going to be doing, you know, vaccines, you know, they might get notice of that. The point is that if somebody complains and says, wait, I didn't want my kid to get shot, or my kid had a exemption on record, why did you vaccinate my kid? Because accidents are going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's just a statistically unavoidable thing. We hope that it's a very tiny percentage. But there was a news article several months ago talking about where school staff members were all – they thought they were vaccinating them, and they were actually giving them, injecting them with some sort of, I don't remember what it was, diabetes medication or something. I mean, it was something completely unrelated. They just injected the wrong substance into these people. And unfortunately, human beings, you know, part of what comes with the package of being human is being imperfect. And those kind of things we hope happen rarely, you know, as rarely and seldom as possible, but they are going to happen. And when you start turning educational institutions into distributions for medical services and in particular vaccines, you're going to have, you know, some accidents along the way. But even assuming it's a perfect setup, the point here is if there's a law in place that says the minors can consent, it doesn't matter if you have an exemption. I mean, there's not going to be anything you can prosecute there, or there might be, but it certainly complicates things. And it looks to me like there's a, of course, this is speculation on my part, but it doesn't seem to me that this is accidental. It seems to me that this is part of a larger plan to maximize distribution of vaccines. Now, I just read a very interesting and frankly disturbing commentary from Dr. Paul King. He's with CoMed, an organization that is whose goal and purpose and function is to remove mercury from vaccines and other medications. And he was pointing out something that I hadn't seen before and citing all of the precise numbers, figures, and sources to go with it as a medical researcher. But along with the mercury being reduced in vaccines. Now, just as a side note, for a vaccine to be called mercury-free, that doesn't mean it has no mercury in it. That just means it has to have mercury below a certain level. So mercury has been substantially reduced in a number of vaccines. However, mercury is now in flu vaccines, which are recommended for children as young as 6 months old. And over the course of a child's life, if they get all of the flu vaccines that are recommended and all the mandatory vaccines, they're actually going to have a higher exposure, up to about 1.5 times the previous mercury exposure before you started reducing mercury in vaccines. And that was a very interesting and disturbing thing to read, that now that we
because
have mercury...
Because it's cumulative.
Because there's a cumulative effect, and well, it's different with everybody. Some, as I understand it from Dr. King, different people's bodies have different abilities, greater or lesser abilities to excrete or eliminate mercury. There is a cumulative effect. That's going to vary from individual to individual, though. But the point being that the overall exposure over time, now that we have so-called mercury-free vaccines, the overall exposure can actually be greater. I mean, how ironic is that? You know, deliberate or not, you know, I'll leave that to anyone to speculate on their own. But the deliberate or not, it certainly it seems counterintuitive to the notion that at least...
Basically what we're saying here is that accidents will happen and children will get vaccinated against the wishes of parents just because things, when they're institutionalized and all records are not in, there can be these accidental occurrences to be expected, but that overall you're saying legislative action is being amended so that children are now getting consent to have medical procedures, not only in emergency situations, but outside of emergency situations, and that parents are losing more of their overall overseeing, whatever that word is, for their children. Knowing before something actually happens to their child and gets a report, oh, today we did such and such. So they're losing their ability to be the guardian of their child, to be responsible for their health and well-being due to these legislative changes?
Well, to the extent that a minor has authority to consent on their own to medical treatment, then the medical community and perhaps coupled with the pharmaceutical industry here, has the authority to provide services. Now, I don't think, for example, there's a section in the current, and now let me explain that in California and North Carolina, there is current law that gives minors some authority to consent to at least some medical treatments, and it looks to me like that includes vaccines. There are also bills in both North Carolina and California to amend the current law, not having anything to do with the issues that I'm talking about today, that they are potentially either partially or fully unconstitutional. But and the amendment that was on a current bill here in North Carolina is no longer current. It's from the current session, but was withdrawn for some funding-related issue that I don't have have complete information on, so I can't explain that. But the point is that that bill was withdrawn, but the current law is still there, as I read a few minutes ago, that allows the minors to give consent. And so
that was letter B. Any minor who is emancipated may consent to any medical treatment, dental, and health services for himself or for his child.
Well, that's a separate issue. I was reading under A. B there, emancipation is where somebody who is under 18 is granted, essentially granted parental status by the courts. And probably most, if not all, states have some provision. If you have a situation, with a little imagination, most of us could probably envision situations, and in any event, they do occur, where people under 18 necessarily either have to because of circumstances or end up, in any event, being on their own and caring for themselves. So in North Carolina, for example, and I don't know the precise details off the top of my head, but something like if you were, say, 16 or 17 and you were employed and you were living in your own apartment, you could probably petition the court and have a good chance of being granted emancipation, which basically gives you adult status even though you're still you would otherwise, because of not being 18, be a minor. If somebody is functionally in the position of caring for themselves and doing so responsibly and adequately, and it doesn't really make sense that they should be limited to having their parents' consent for things mm-hmm. that other similarly situated adults don't have to. So that just says that basically if you're emancipated, if the court has said you get to be an adult even though you're not old enough to be an adult because you are in a situation where you've demonstrated, you know, that you are functioning effectively like an adult, then of course you can consent to any medical treatment. And I don't have a problem with that. And if you have children, you know, for your children as well. But a situation where children are not emancipated and are minors, legal minors under the age of 18, it raises some serious questions. Now, I can imagine, and I don't get too far off on a tangent here, but I could imagine if I were 17 and contracted a sexually transmitted disease, I would really love to be able to go to a doctor and not have my parents know about that and get treated. I can, you know, we can envision the situation. Now, as a parent, if that happened to my child, I would want to know about it, but I can certainly imagine older
children. Or the pregnancy issue is listed there.
Right. To either, and again, there are going to be people who will, you know, have very strong feelings on different sides of the issue, and I'm not taking a position on any of them at this point, but I can see why a child at 17 would want to either be able to get help from a doctor if it was needed to avoid pregnancy, or maybe to get an abortion if that's appropriate and allowed. And anyway, to deal with that issue, I can see where older minor children would like to have the ability to do that outside of their parents' knowledge. But again, there's a flip side to that. As a parent, do you want to know and be informed, be involved? I mean, if your child is getting pregnant near but before the age of 18, or especially if it's not near the age of 18 and before the age of 18, do you want to be involved to know about that? Should you, as a parent, do you have a responsibility to be involved? You know, there are more, that kind of a situation has implications beyond just the fact of the pregnancy. And there are so many issues there, emotionally, mental health issues, circumstances and so forth that can be involved with that. And a competent parent, one could argue, should be informed and be consenting to what's going on and fully informed and involved and working with their children to deal with whatever the issues surrounding that are. But again, we have to distinguish between what we think our rights should be. The point is, people can argue that different ways. But while we can discuss that on a philosophical level of what we think our rights should be, there's a separate question that's a analytical question legally, which is, well, what are our rights? And let's figure out what that is first. And then if we don't like what that is, what steps can we take, if any, to change that to what we might want it to be? So again, my position on this at this point is that under Troxell, U.S. Supreme Court case, parents have a 14th Amendment due process right to rear their children. And so states cannot properly enact a law that would take that decision-making authority away unless, and to use the language from Troxell, there is a threshold showing of harm. In other words, if someone wants to introduce a law that says if a child is at risk of harm or has been harmed, then the child may consent to medical treatment for this, that, and the other. And I think, you know, there might be need to be more detailed language there, but in terms of the concept, if they include this required threshold showing of harm, then maybe that's a constitutional law.
What is the definition of the harm, right? We need to have that.
Well,
I mean,
right,
that has to be
right,
spelled out more specifically.
Right, and probably the standard there would be a reasonable standard under current law in society would be that a physician maybe gets to decide what that is, or some appropriate expert, when you're talking about health issues, would be able to decide that. Now, you know, is when you're talking about vaccines in a non-emergency situation, I don't think you could reasonably say that any routine immunization, whether it's one that's mandated or not, or just recommended, I don't think you could say that any routine immunization is an emergency or a immediate risk of harm at such a level that somebody other than the parent should make that could legally make that decision. But again, there's different.
But it blurs the line, though. Is that what you're saying?
The line is blurred, but there's sort of two different questions here. One, is there a legal standard, and what is it? And we're using fairly general language to describe that standard here. The phrase from Troxell is threshold showing of harm. And then the second question is, well, how do you define that? And that's a place where, again, reasonable people are going to disagree, but let's get that starting point in there, because right now these two laws don't have any threshold showing of harm in them at all in North Carolina or California. And if there are similar laws in other states, and I expect if we looked, we would find laws or bills in other states that are doing this. And it's very disconcerting to me as it pertains to vaccines specifically, but beyond that as well.
Well, we can see a situation where a kid is in the athletic department and playing something and then gets a head injury and needs to be cared for, or he falls and gets a cut and needs to be cared for. Obviously, the child is in a situation and those all around him know this is immediate care, this is emergency care. But Dr. Bob is asking a question that I was insinuating a little bit earlier. How can a child ever have the intellectual maturity and the scientific critical thinking ability to decide on whether or not they should be vaccinated, and especially in situations where the county or whoever it is who's putting out a contest, I put that in quotes, that they are marketing to the child and giving them I don't want to call it sour grape. What is it called when you're putting a carrot in front of them to say this is going to be something sweet and good for you without them having full knowledge, full information, the pros and cons to weigh the issue, and the intellectual maturity to make a decision?
Well, and again, there are a multitude of different aspects and issues in that question. First of all, this is what really disturbed me about the idea, or one of the things that really disturbed me about the idea of schools dispensing flu vaccines, because children are under an enormous amount of peer pressure, and that peer pressure is no stronger anywhere else than in school, or generally speaking, anyway.
Well, they have a tremendous number of videos. In the UK, they have an incredible campaign going for every girl to get the Gardasil, and now it's moving to the boys. But, you know, it is a tremendous thing. Who in your classroom, how many kids in your classroom can you get to get this vaccination?
Oh, yeah, you know, and they'll have pizza parties and prizes, no doubt, for whoever gets, you know, the highest percentage vaccinated in their class or whatever, you know, if that sort of thing plays out. But by definition, the reason we have, the reason we draw a line and say, you know, when you turn 18, you're a legal adult, and before that, you're legally a minor, or sometimes in law they use the word infant to refer to anybody under 18. That can be really confusing if you're reading that as the more common use of a child under the age of one. But by definition, a minor is deemed not to have capacity to consent. Minors can't legally enter into
legal contracts,
for example, because by law they are deemed to be incompetent to make those decisions. Now, you know, I had a brief discussion with my 17-year-old this morning about this. Of course, there are many children who, in their teens, as a practical matter, would be very competent to, for example, enter into certain kinds of contracts or to assume to one degree or another certain kinds of adult responsibilities. And I think we would all agree there are many adults, some well into adult years, who just lack competence, you know, for all the things that they nonetheless have, or many of the things that they nonetheless have legal responsibility for. But, you know, so the law, I think it would be impractical for the law to try to assess on a case-by-case basis who is capable of being adult and who is not. So what the law does is maybe the next best thing. They draw a somewhat arbitrary line, but it's a well-established one at this point. In any event, probably most, if not all, states, you're a legal adult when you're 18, even though, you know, even if you're not able to drink alcohol until you're 21, for example. But For most purposes, at 18, whether you are, as a practical matter, competent or not, you are legally competent. But it's absolutely a fundamental, critical question. When you start talking about children consenting to anything, you are saying, let's go against this long-held, well-established principle that, by definition, children are not competent. And that's a separate question from what's a parent's constitutional rights. But I think it's the two different questions profoundly reinforce one another. That is, there's a really serious question. Now, if I'm on the other side of this, if I'm a pharmaceutical company looking to expand my vaccine market and expand profits, and if I have no conscience and no connection between my head and my heart and so forth, you know, how do I go beyond the parent? How do I get around these anti-vaccine people, because they're really starting to annoy me? And how do I get into other markets? How do I bypass their potential resistance? And how do I get to all the people who, if it were convenient, they'd get the vaccine. If it's not, they won't get around to it. Who don't have any objection to vaccines. You know, how do I maximize my distribution and profits? And boy, if I could get vaccines distributed in the schools, I could get to almost every child out there, everybody but the homeschoolers. And, you know, so from a marketing perspective, it makes sense that they might, and given the track record of unethical and immoral practices of the pharmaceutical industry in general, and that's not a label, by the way, or a phrase I use casually, but when you have something like, for example, Pfizer, who in 2009 gets a $1 billion criminal fine and a $1.3 billion civil fine, and one of the reasons that the criminal fine was $1 billion was because it's the fourth time they'd engaged in the same criminal behavior. And when, by definition, the criminal fine means you've done something that you knew was criminal, but you did it anyway, and that may be the largest single criminal fine, at least that I'm aware of, but there are many, many other fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
When we have this type of background and information about a company who is involved with producing and distributing these medical supplies, does the legislator look at that information when they're trying to make changes to the wording in bills or propose new legislation?
Oh, boy, that is such a complex question. There is the framework by which the legislative system presumably operates. There is the face that legislators put on the process. Then there is the way things really work. And the way things really work involve lots of politics, not in the sort of neutral structure of the system sense of the word, but in the I'll scratch your back if you scratch my back sense of the word, and other kinds of things. It's clear to me that whether it's deliberate or not, that legislators on the whole over the years have enacted laws at state and federal level that support industry, not just in pharmaceutical and in health, but in other areas as well, that support industry at times to the detriment of the legislators' constituencies. And, you know, that's an inherently complex question and issue. But suffice it to say for our purposes at the moment here that we have a pharmaceutical industry that is on record of having nearly $1 billion in fines annually for the last 20 years, and sometimes in the last 5 years, according to at least one source that I read that said 3/4 of that has been in the last 5 years, so that would mean about roughly $3 billion in civil and criminal fines annually in the last 5 years. It's gotten worse. Either it's gotten worse or the prosecution has gotten better. My point is that if those people, we know that there are people in the pharmaceutical industry who are willing to market their products in such a way that they know is criminal. And the only reason you would repeat that kind of behavior is if you don't get caught every time you do it. If there would have to be a net profit to doing that kind of behavior, you wouldn't keep doing it. You know, this Pfizer, it was the fourth time they get caught. Well, how many times did they do it and not get caught? Because if every time they got caught, they were nailed for it, it's hard to see that they would keep doing it. Or if it is, they are getting caught every time they do it, then obviously the fines aren't big enough because they keep doing it. In other words, it's a net profit even though they get caught and pay fines. If they're willing to function in that way as a business, as an ongoing, you know, manner of practice and marketing, we aren't safe relying fully and wholly on this industry to treat and cure or prevent disease and health conditions and problems. So it's maybe an understatement to say that the allopathic pharmaceutical industry is a buyer beware proposition. And all the more disturbing then on moral and ethical grounds that vaccines are mandated anywhere ever, given the industry that comes from.
Did you want to go into the California bill?
Well, yes, we can talk about that a little bit. It's the same basic concept. For example, the current bill, which is seeking to modify an existing law that gives minors a certain amount of consent already. But for example, the bill to modify that has a paragraph that says a minor who is 12 years of age or older may consent to medical care related to the prevention of a sexually transmitted disease. That means they can give boys and girls Gardasil if the children say okay. Well, if a doctor comes into, let's say, a school classroom, or even a school nurse, and gives a five-minute speech about how wonderful vaccines are, how wonderful this new cancer-preventing vaccine is, and everybody should get it, how many 12-year-old children are going to stand up and say, well, you know, actually, the Gardasil vaccine has killed over 90 girls, and then there's this huge number of reported adverse events. Kids aren't going to have that information, and they're not going to have that knowledge, they're not going to have that understanding. Most children perhaps at least up until mid to late teens, are pretty trusting of the information they're taught in school. They may not like school. They may not like having to learn. They may or may not do well on tests and all of that.
Yeah, but they're authority.
Is, yeah,
they look at them as authority.
And most of us who are, you know, most of us who don't even as adults get to a point where we question authority in any significant or substantial way, the minority of us, at least at this point, who get to the point where we go doing research and we say, wow, there are serious problems with vaccines and other things in healthcare. How old were you, Debbie, when you stumbled onto this issue? And, you know, how long did it take you? And I'm asking this as a rhetorical question, but,
yeah.
You know,
until I was totally consciously aware as a mature adult?
Yeah, I was in my mid-30s when I first encountered the vaccine issue, and it was a period of months before I could even get over the initial shock, and a period of years before I had researched this issue and related issues thoroughly enough to really convince myself or to see the extent of the problem and issue, and that's an ongoing process. But you're not going to find children who have the maturity, let alone the information and ability to assess the information to make reasonable decisions as a practical matter. As a legal matter, I think Troxell tells us that that is a parent's right regardless of any individual child's ability to assess and make informed choices.
Right. And here in this legislation, it says 6926, it says a minor who is 12 years of age or older and who may have come in contact with an infectious, contagious, or communicable disease may consent to medical care related to the diagnosis or treatment of the disease, if the disease or condition is one that is required by law or regulation adopted pursuant to law to be reported to the local health officer, or is related to is a related sexually transmitted disease, as may be determined by the state director of health services. They keep bringing the age limit lower and lower. So now you're talking about a 12-year-old child. And, you know, what age are they going to move it to? A minor who is 12 years of age or older may consent to medical care and counseling related to the diagnosis and treatment of a drug or alcohol-related problem. So you would think when you get a child who's drunk or something or has been in an accident, you immediately get in a automobile, a police, and have a report made and call the parent, call the guardian, take the child home, let them know what's going on. But there's sort of like this intermediate step where they're intervening in between what should be the parent's right.
Well, in one sense, and it's really difficult for me not to be cynical at this point, but this really, to me, smacks of one of the fundamental problems with and corruption in the intermingling, the unethical, if not outright immoral, intermingling of industry and government. This is just an attempt to slip under the radar of anti-vaccine people and constitutional law to slip underneath that to expand pharmaceutical market. This is about increasing vaccination rates and other treatment rates on a lesser level to the credit of financial gain of doctors who would be dispensing this at the cost of we the people, because this stuff is going to be paid for by the state. You know, there's a section at the bottom of this California bill that says the minor's parents are not liable for payment. And that seems only fair and appropriate that some, you know, you wouldn't treat a child without getting the parents' consent and then send them a bill and say, we did something, we can't tell you what it is, but please pay
for
it.
Well, I have a question. Should they be refining the wording more so that, I mean, if my child was raped or injured in some way, you know, I would want that child to be cared for immediately. I want them to have a counselor, a therapist to help them through the emotional trauma. I want them to make sure that they are not physically damaged and treated properly.
I want to be called to come
there with them. But when you're talking about doing some sort of a vaccination. It's almost as if there should be a separate clause for that. Because it's different.
Yeah, it's not, from my point of view, it's not about refining the wording. It's that these laws in their entirety need to be scrapped. And there probably are already laws or already legal principles in common law, even if they're not articulated in regulations or statutes, that allow, for example, a parent's 14th Amendment due process right to rear their children, allow that right to be temporarily suspended in an emergency. Now, if we want to get into splitting hairs on what defines an emergency for purposes of statutes and regulations, maybe that's a reasonable place for us to go. But I don't think it's about changing the wording here and there in current laws. I think the current laws seem to go out either in defiance of or in ignorance of the parent's fundamental constitutional right. And the idea of a child consenting to anything needs to go out the window. If somebody wants to use a statute or regulation to clarify the what is probably a common law principle already in our law that rights can be suspended temporarily during an emergency, and they want to split hairs about what does or doesn't count as an emergency, that's fine. We can go with that. And if they overstep their boundaries there, we could challenge that. You know, the lines constitutionally in court. But I really think it's a fundamental...
But what I'm saying here is they're itemizing in this particular bill, this California thing, they're saying treatment of drug or alcohol-related problems, treatment of pregnancy, treatment of sexual assault, treatment... You know, they're listing them specifically in what cases... A child, a minor child who is 12 years of age, may consent. So that's why I'm saying, why are they itemizing and pulling these specific things out? There's one for mental health treatment or counseling on an outpatient basis.
This bill seeks to amend current law, and we'd have to look at what the current law is and look at the differences to see why they're doing the wording they're doing. What I'm saying is the laws need to be repealed. They need to be scratched altogether. And then, because a child can't consent to anything, and a child doesn't need to consent to emergency treatment, that's a decision that can be made by a medical professional. You know, this child... is in an auto accident, you don't have to, you know, you don't ask the child, is it okay for us to treat you? You're bleeding to death. A medical professional makes the determination that the child's situation requires immediate treatment and then gives the treatment. And I believe that medical professionals already have that authority. But if the state wants to come in and again, split hairs and say these following situations or conditions will constitute an emergency that a physician can treat without the parent's consent, fine. But I don't think the child can consent to anything, because I think the parent's fundamental constitutional right doesn't allow the child to do that. I think the question is not whether children can consent. They can't. They're legally incompetent to consent until they become an adult.
Okay, answers that question. And
when can somebody else decide, another adult decides, this is a doctor, without the parent's consent?
That is great. I think we really covered this issue completely, and we're at the end of time. We're going to close for today and see you next Thursday at noon. Thank you so much for listening to Homeopathy World Community Radio. Okay. Take care now, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Think of us together, like people everywhere. We dream about a world at work where people really care. Our past and our lives before us, our journeys can't be ended. So they do what we bring us, the wisdom. We are reaching the world. Allow our souls to shine, reaching for the greater love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your song be unfurled. One by one, we are changing the world. God is flaming, and as its radiance grows brighter, to the world will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one, we are freeing the world. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one, we are.